This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Dan Hurley. Tens of thousands of students will go back to class at local colleges over the next several weeks. What are parents and what are the colleges doing to create a direct and honest conversation about the issues of campus sexual assault? And how can community organizations that care about this issue, including those that interact regularly with students, create practices that will assist? To discuss that, we are joined now by the Executive Director for Gender Equity and Inclusion and Title IX Coordinator for the University of Cincinnati, Andrea Goldblum.
Hi.
The Title IX officer for the office in the office of the provost and chief academic officer at Xavier University, Kate Lawson. The CEO of Women Helping Women, Kristen Shrimplin. Good to have you here. And Maria Cole, the prevention specialist for Women Helping Women. You can join our conversation by calling 513-419-7100 or email us at talk@wvxu.org. We're also on Twitter and Facebook. Welcome, everybody.
Thanks. To
Cincinnati Edition. I hope you had a chance to listen in to a little bit of that conversation, because what we were talking about the first time really flows into exactly what we're talking about here. So, Andrea, let's just start with what your reaction to that report that came out Sunday and is online from the Cincinnati Enquirer. How do you think you might use it in your work? How could it be useful to you?
I think we could use it in a variety of ways. One is to make it accessible on our website for students. Another is to use pieces of it in training and in presentations with students. These are real people, and real things happened. Mm-hmm. And this illustrates the impact on everybody involved and what some of the factors are. And so it really would help to have that in front of people as starting points for discussion.
Yeah. It seems to me it could be really a wealth of not only information, but sort of sparking the sort of conversations that everybody says, well, these are difficult conversations. But Kate, you're at Xavier, and one of the people that was interviewed by the Enquirer reporters, Leah Sprock, she was a college student, said, well, I think it happened in the first couple of weeks when you come to college, because it's part of that, like, freedom from your parents. I feel like kids are, yeah, we're still kids. Let's be real. At my age, we don't realize that we're not invincible. So is this time of the year, as students are coming back on campus, a particularly vulnerable time for students in this issue?
It is. And actually, there's a lot of national research to support that the first 6 to 8 weeks, especially for incoming students, is a very vulnerable time, sometimes referred to as the red zone, where students may have particular vulnerabilities, lack of a social system built up, particularly not experience with alcohol, potentially. Again, what I heard Kate and Meg talk about, sort of inundated by a ton of information and trying to sift through, and you may not pick up that first 6 weeks. What do I do if something happens to me? Or how does this university define these issues? Who do I go to talk to? I think an important thing and a shift of my mindset over the last 5 years at Xavier is it's a very vulnerable time, but it's also a time of enormous opportunity to really share with our students through multiple dosage, entry points, mediums, including using this incredible piece of journalism. To really meet students where they are and start to tell them, hey, this is what the culture is at Xavier, at UC. This is how, these are our social norms. And it's that first conversation, and there's a lot of other noise, but we've really focused at Xavier trying to figure out, instead of sort of being afraid of the red zone, how do we really amplify student leader voices, peer-to-peer, things we know work, bystander engagement, all of those pieces, and partnering with community leaders like Women Helping Women to amplify that message.
Yeah, one of the things that I noticed that another student said was, oh, I'm sure they talked about this during orientation, and I'm sure they passed out some sort of card. I don't know where the card is, and I don't know what they said. But you're saying you just got to find better ways and to get this out of the clutter of all the other things that incoming students are trying to deal with.
I think that's right. And I also think that you can't expect to teach consent, healthy mm-hmm. relationships, or healthy sexual decision making in 6 weeks. So you really have to look at the long game and integrate these topics from the moment the student engages with your university through orientation. That's a critical spot, but not through a one-time talk, but through maybe large group settings and then small group dialogue. I mean, mm-hmm. at Xavier, students can't get away from it. And I think that's a very positive thing, because what they're hearing is this matters to Xavier. And all right, I thought to myself the first time, this doesn't apply to me. I remember one of the students in the video said, this will never happen to me. There's only so many times until a person's like, all right, you know what? Actually, I did know someone in high school who was in an abusive mm-hmm. relationship. Now that I hear you say it that way. So really, I think most universities are trying to say, we can't do this in a weekend. We need to talk to students about this from their entire journey, multiple levels, meeting them where they are.
Kristen, you're with Women Helping Women. Mm-hmm. What we're talking about today is really focused at the university, not that this isn't a larger problem in the larger society as well, but we're talking about on college campuses or around college campuses. What can be the role of Women Helping Women in this sort of situation?
Yeah, there's a lot of areas for roles with Women Helping Women. Our mission is to prevent gender-based violence and empower all survivors. So there are two key words there, right? Prevent and empower. So to amplify what Kate was talking about previously, we need to build a culture, whether that's at Xavier or whether that's at UC or at Miami University. But we need to back that up of the pipeline culture around consent, right? We all are raised in rape culture. So we need to turn that into a tipping point and being raised in consent culture. That doesn't start the first week at school, right? What starts there is the red zone, and we can look at creative ways to harness that, to activate, the social capital in school to really have a prevention focus. But we have to back up that pipeline, and that's what Women Helping Women does. That's why we run an evidence-based prevention programming in middle schools and high schools, about 25 high schools in this region. We do that curriculum with about 4,500 students. So that's the first core piece. And then what can we do in relationships to the campuses and what's happening? We're sending our children to school to get their academic pursuits. They're going for an education. We're not sending them there for sexual violence. Yep. So that's why Women Helping Women has confidential advocates based at University of Cincinnati. We respond and collaborate with Xavier University, and we have a confidential advocate at Miami University.
What's a confidential advocate?
It's one of our advocates who's housed on the university. So we will show up and support survivors as they drive that process. Mm-hmm. If they want to report, great. We'll walk that path with them. If they don't want to report, that's fine too. We'll walk that path with them.
Okay. Maria, you're also at Women Helping Women, and you have helped, as I understand it, sort of create a program that's out in the community, but a part of the community that a lot of college students are going to have interactions with. And can you tell us a little bit about the Lexi program and what that is?
Yeah, so I lead it's on a SPAR training through Women Helping Women. The Lexi program, so the Ask for Lexi posters are part of the BAR training program. Before my time at Women Helping Women, the agency saw a need and responded to the need in the service industry in Cincinnati. So our program is we essentially review all of the policies for a specific bar. We go in, we do 2 hours of training with their staff about definitions of gender-based violence, warning signs of gender-based violence happening in the bar, and then bystander intervention training. So encouraging those industry members to be upstanders, to be on the lookout for.
Upstanders versus bystanders, right?
Yeah. So we want them to be proactive. We want them to take charge of a situation if they see that gender-based violence is happening in their bar or in their establishment. And so far, we've trained 9 local bars, and we're looking to expand that as much as possible. We really want the bar training to become a norm in Cincinnati.
One of the triggers here is that if a person feels that they're in trouble, they can say to anybody working in that particular establishment, I'd like to see Lexi. Is that what it is? Is that sort of the code word?
Yeah. So during our training, we go over a poster that my colleague M created based off of the Ask for Angela campaign. And so if someone is in danger in a bar situation, they can go up to any bar staff member who's been trained in this and ask for Lexi. So supposedly Lexi is a staff member, and that staff member who is responding to that situation, responding to that potential survivor, will know that that person is in trouble and they need to get them out of that situation.
Okay. Yesterday, we asked people who might want to send in questions ahead of time to do that. And somebody did ask a question. So I'd like to play that right now, and then we will be able to give you a chance to sort of respond to that.
I was 20 years old and a day when I started working at a bar in Northern Kentucky in college, and was a server. And the bartender that we worked with was very cute and invited me out for a date. But the date ended with me waking up at his house and empty condom wrappers around. Being young, my thought immediately was how disgusting that he didn't clean up from the last time he had a girl here. Took a little while to realize what happened. I blamed myself because I had thought I had gotten too drunk. In my opinion, and talking with other people from seeing me that evening, I wasn't just drunk. It was something in addition to drinking that was used. So training bartenders, I think, is a great idea, but what happens when the bartender is the perpetrator?
Lots of things going on in that particular question. Last segment, we were talking about alcohol. Now we're talking about adding things and the bartender himself. So anyway.
And that's part of what gave really helped us understand what the need was in the community. You know, at Women Helping Women, we would love to come up with all of our programs in our own mind, but that's not how this works. We look at the need in community, and everything is survivor-driven. Survivors are the ones who utilize their voices around what was happening to them in the bar industry. And it was very similar situations to what the caller just explained. So that's why we go in. And it's not just a training to help patron to patron. We really go with that policy review so that from top down, it is understood how is this a inclusive and safe workplace, and how do we hold those who are accountable for their actions up to and including termination, and what is that culture we want to create?
We have a caller, Daniel, great name, by the way, who I had called in and has an observation about his own situation. Daniel, what is your question, observation?
Yeah, I mean, I kind of just want to speak for people in my position, for one. Two things. One, I am an alcoholic. I do have a condition that I've been struggling with for 10 years to get a hold of, and it's not very easy for me, probably because I'm just part of a percentage of the population that can't really handle alcohol very well and make good decisions. Number two, I'm a male, too, who also has been taken advantage of other females that have taken advantage of me, you know, not making the best decisions when I'm under the influence of alcohol. I just kind of want to reinforce for anybody listening to this conversation that when somebody's under the influence of drugs or alcohol, no matter whether they're a man or a woman, they really can't make good decisions. And I've made pretty bad decisions for the past 10 years of my life, and I have been taking advantage of people financially and sexually for, you know, a lot in a lot of situations. And I just want to reinforce that just because someone gives verbal consent or, you know, any kind of consent, you know, when as long as they're under the influence of alcohol, especially, which is really one of the worst drugs out there, even though it's very socially acceptable, yep. for a large percentage of the population like me, I know that it's a problem thinking that that's okay to do to somebody, whether
okay,
they're a man or a woman.
Let's let people respond to that. Anybody want to?
Sure. Well, I appreciate what you said, Daniel, and alcohol is actually the number one date rape drug. People often think it's roofies or GHB or some of the others, but it is alcohol. And I think that Daniel brings up a good point in that anyone can be a victim and anyone can be a perpetrator. It's not just males assaulting females. Any possible gender configuration that there is can result in an assault. And so when we are doing prevention, when we are responding to situations, we always need to keep that in mind and make sure that the work that we're doing is culturally competent and that we're not feeding into assumptions that it's just males assaulting females.
Which just reinforces sort of the cultural assumptions that we were talking about the first part of the show.
Absolutely.
You don't want to reinforce those. Kate, I want to move on to, and Daniel, thank you for your question and your willingness to call in and talk about that. Kate, as you listen to all the people that are interviewed by the Enquirer, and whether it's students, whether it's women or men, whether it's attorneys, whether it's administrators, everybody seems uncomfortable with the process that's in place for investigations and hearings once a complaint has been filed. Nobody seems to be happy with the situation as it is. And can you tell us a little bit about where you stand on this and what Xavier University, in your particular situation, is trying to do to improve the how you handle complaints?
Sure. So just to sort of lay the groundwork, Title IX, federal civil rights law that requires any institution, any education institution, you know, kindergarten through doctorate, to have policies in place, internal policies entirely separate from the criminal justice response that talk about how we define sex discrimination. And under that falls a lot of different types of conduct, but certainly sexual assault is under there. And that civil rights law requires universities to investigate. And if someone comes forward to say something has happened to me as a student, as an employee, as a visitor, and I want you, Xavier University, to investigate and determine if this person is a member of our community, have they violated our internal policies? So that's what the law requires. And certainly I would say at Xavier, what our mission requires. Title IX is about access to education. And if you know anyone who has experienced sexual assault while in education setting, whether it's middle school or college, their education is definitively interrupted and disrupted. So we have a responsibility
because
to address that.
They can just simply be afraid to be on the campus, to be
sure,
going to class.
Afraid to go to class, afraid to be in their residence hall where it happened, afraid to go into the dining hall. And as you hear that, you hear basics, shelter, food, privacy, mental health. If you are in a abusive relationship and someone is texting you 100 times a day in your biology class, you're not doing well in the biology class. So just to give some example there, the way that, first I'll just acknowledge, it is an extremely difficult process for all parties involved, and not just the reporting party and the responding party, but their families, their halls, their teams. I think I've never seen an issue that people, a culture, want to look away from quite as much as sexual assault. And people will put all kinds of parameters, including the one that Daniel shared, only happens to women, only happens to people intoxicated, only happens to fill in the blank, to keep from having to look at it. That's what part of our prevention education does. But the way Xavier tries to make an extremely difficult process as accessible as possible is by having our process fully driven by our mission, which is, you know, in solidarity with each other, care for the entire person, not having a process or policies that are based on bias or gender assumptions, but rather on care for the whole person in a process that one person is coming out of an investigation and a conduct process not happy with the outcome.
One question I have is that, Andrea, let me direct this at you. Is it true that, say, someone who is accused of an assault, not the victim has accused another person, the person who is accused could literally just withdraw from the university, transfer to another university, and that's the end of it? There's nothing that goes on the record anyplace. There's nothing to alert the next university. Is that true?
Some of that depends on the policies of the university that they're going to transfer to, as well as the university they're transferring from. If somebody leaves, a hold can be placed on their records and registration so that they can't get transcripts until they resolve the issue. Or there might be a notation on their transcript that says issue pending. So that alerts the other institution. The other institution can ask, has there been any disciplinary history? Or is there any other issue that is not resolved yet?
Well, clearly we've run out of time and we could spend a lot more time on this. Thank you to everybody for being here today. You've been listening to Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. The producer for today's show is Pete Reitmeier. The assistant producer, Selena Reeder. The technical director, Josh Elstro. Archives of our program are available on the website, wvxu.org. I'm Dan Hurley.